What's up, everybody? Orlando here from the On Cue podcast, and today's guest is one of my favorite. We have Tom Murphy on with us today. You get both of us, Nicole and I. It's the complete On Cue podcast with one of my favorite humans, Tom Murphy. He's a good friend of mine. We've known each other, I think, for about 12, 13 years now, and he's been a big mentor in my life, both personally and professionally. We get along well. I respect the guy. He's done a lot of good for his community and our community as a whole. And I really hope you just enjoy getting to know him a little bit. We will have him on probably every few months at least because there's a lot to learn from the guy. And he has a lot of good information to share and can really help get people in touch with other people. And that's what this is all about. So we hope you enjoy getting to know Tom, a little bit about him, and a little bit about us, our backstory. It's really a good time with myself, Nicole, and Tom Murphy.
Okay, so we're sitting here with Orlando's best friend. Would you consider him your best friend?
Close friend. I have a few close friends. Yeah, he's probably.
If we get married with the whole like wedding shit, I think he'd say you'd be his best man.
No, we've already tried that. Right? we've already done that.
Oh yeah, I was supposed to, sorry, you're supposed to be another person. My bad.
Who said that? No, we've already gone down that road. Yeah, to answer your question, we're editing this now. Jesus.
So it's Orlando's best friend, and I wanted to open it up because my people, they know Orlando, but don't know Orlando. And it's interesting how these two met because Tom hired Orlando back in 2007. Yeah, and he answered an ad on.
No, I don't know. No. So what happened was, you're right about May. I decided to move to Vermont.
No.
How I met Tom, how Tom hired me. Is that the question?
Was it online?
That's what I'm, yeah. So what happened was, there was a guy that was already working there, and his wife knew my friend who I was moving up there, right? And knew I was looking for a job, my ex, so Sarah's daughter. So she had a friend whose husband, or at the time, yeah, whose husband was Lucky, and my friend Scott Lucero. And so he really liked Tom, he liked working there, he knew I was looking for a job. And the guy, I never even met Lucky, actually, was because of his wife, got me Tom's information. And so I called this Lucky guy, you know, got to know him. He's like, yeah, I can't promise you anything, but I can introduce you to this fella named Tom. He's my boss.
And then you lied, said that you have a plane ticket and you didn't.
That's right. So I emailed Tom and he blew me off. And I emailed Tom again and he blew me off. And I already made up my mind when I was moving to Vermont, but I had no job. I had nothing. I had already told my job, my current job, I'd given them a month heads up that I was leaving.
How old were you?
I was 25. And I already quit my job and my lease was up. So I knew I was moving to Vermont, but I didn't have a job. And Tom kept blowing me off. You know, I'm just some guy in Texas. He wasn't being personal. He just, you know, and then finally, I sent him an email and said, hey, I'm going to be up there. I sent him this email at the end of a week and was like, I'm going to be up there next week for some job interviews. I'm busy all day, but I'm open between 9 and 11 in the morning. But I didn't have a job. I didn't even have a plane ticket yet. I didn't have one job interview. But I told him that I had a bunch of job interviews because in my mind at the time, being so young, I was like, that's going to make it sound like I've got other opportunities.
And it was for train dispatching, right?
Yeah, to be a train dispatcher.
And so for people that don't know that Orlando runs a train dispatch center now.
It runs itself, but yes, I'm responsible for it.
Okay.
So anyway, I tell Tom in this via email that I'm only available from 9 to 11 on this date. And he says, okay, I'll be available. You can come see me. So now I'm scrambling. This is like a Thursday. I'm supposed to see him on Tuesday. So I buy a plane ticket. I fly up there. I fly in Monday night. Have a job interview Tuesday morning, and I leave Tuesday afternoon and fly all the way back to Waco, Texas. And he hired me, dumbass.
Why are you saying that to me?
What? Say what?
Oh, he called you a dumbass.
Yeah, he hired me. Crazy.
Well, master. Well, truth be told.
Tom, would you like to say hi?
Yeah.
Well, hi, family, people, community.
Yeah.
Well, truth be told, we should put this on the record correctly. Truth be told, I had just moved from one house to another.
Oh, jeez.
And
oh, gosh.
And in the backyard was this wonderful apple tree.
I mean, again, I've heard you tell this story.
It's the truth. And truth be told, there are a lot of migrant workers that come to our area.
Isn't this the story that you told at his wedding?
Oh, he's ruined that.
Oh, my God.
That's the reason why you're not going to be the best man again.
That's right. Yeah. That story didn't work too well. Anyway.
So back to the introduction. So that's
so Tom hired Orlando. Yes. And then they became good friends. And kind of a little bit of why we wanted to ask him. I mean, Tom's an incredible individual. So you guys, hopefully we'll learn a lot from him. We both learn a lot from Tom whenever we talk with him. I know I do. You talk to him how many times?
I talk to Tom often. We probably speak once a week at least, typically. Sometimes not, sometimes more.
But... Such good parental advice. Anyway, so...
Oh, you mean parental, like giving us advice on being a parent?
Or just in general.
Okay. And like, I thought you meant like him being our parent. I was like, he's old, but he's not that old. Okay, I'm with you now. I'm following you.
Okay. And so they did MMA together. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, but I didn't do it on the same level as Tom. Tom was a professional.
Tom was really Orlando, great at it.
Well, Orlando would be called, is what we would call a toady.
A toady?
Yeah, he totes your gear around.
Yeah, that's
kind of like a groupie.
That's right.
In martial arts.
So then who started doing it first? He did it first?
Tom's been doing it his whole life.
Oh, okay, so then you learned a lot from him.
Listen, I was sitting around the pool when I was 25 with my friend Bobby. And at the time, I was weighing like...
This is when you were in Waco.
In Waco. And I made the decision to move. And I had heard Tom fought professionally, so I looked him up. And I remember sitting by the pool drinking beer with Bobby in Waco. And I was weighing about 175. No, I'm lying. I was weighing about 180, 185 at the time. And Bobby and I'm shadow boxing by the pool. Never been in a gym in my life. Never done it. Never fought. Never anything. And Bobby's
fought
pumping.
Professionally.
No. I've never fought other than fighting as a kid in the streets.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, but I never had any training.
Yeah.
Zero training. Mm-hmm. And I'm shadow boxing by the pool, and Bobby's pumping me. He's like, "Oh, you're gonna drop the lightweight. You're gonna be fucking these guys up. You're gonna go there. You're gonna kick ass." And I'm like, "Ah!" And I'm like, it's like the all American thing, which you hear from meatheads all the time. 25 years old, I'm still in shape. I'm shadow boxing by the pool. I'm gonna go up there and start training. I'm gonna drop down to lightweight. You're going to see me on TV, pay-per-view, right? So I go up there, and I get the shit beat out of me in every discipline possible. And then I get this crude reality of like, guys, yeah, they've been doing it their whole life. I'm 25 and I'm starting it. There's guys that have been doing it since they were, the way I grew up playing baseball, they grew up wrestling and doing jiu-jitsu and boxing and everything.
See, I didn't know that you grew up with that.
Yeah.
So how long have you been doing it?
I've wrestled my whole life. I mean, it started for me in the sport of wrestling.
That's so cool.
You know, I mean, I had something inside of me that programmed me to put my hands on other people. And, when I went to public school, you know, first day of school, I got detention.
Oh, my God. No wonder you guys are friends.
Recess detention, because when I moved upstate New York at about the age of 10, I jumped on a kid's back. But
in
for
kindergarten.
Me, I know, I was about 10.
Sorry.
When I really started back at the public school system. But my point is, from the time I can remember, my dad and I would wrestle. That was my only form of real true play, was my dad on his knees with snow mittens on and me with kids' boxing gloves. And from the time I can remember, that was my play every single day. And then, of course, as I got older, I found the competitive sport of, you know, high school wrestling, and that just dominated my life for really the next 20 years. I wrestled all through college, and you know, and then once college was done, I wasn't ready to stop competing. You know, I'm a training junkie, and I was very fortunate to find myself about an hour from one of the best teams on planet Earth in mixed martial arts.
Which was who?
A gym in Montreal called TriStar. Okay. A couple world champions have trained there, and I just started training there. One thing led to another, and found myself competing at a pretty high level. And
you did how many fights in the UFC?
Well, I did their reality TV show, which was the big thing.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Yeah, I did the second season of The Ultimate Fighter. Yeah. But truly, I never really competed. I never really got into the sport of mixed martial arts for competition. Because I was in it a little bit late. And when I say a little bit late, I was 27, 28. Even though I had competed in the sport of wrestling and other martial art disciplines, I got into this sport a little bit late. And so for me, it was more of just extension of my collegiate career, because I have to train 6 days a week or I become a very ugly person.
He had to do burpees before we went to dinner tonight.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're an extremist?
Oh, yeah. I don't do things recreationally.
Did you see the struggle he went through tonight trying to eat that carrot cake? We talked about this after we dropped him off. Did you see the struggle?
No.
That wasn't a show. Look, I know this man. My guess would be about as good as he'll allow any man to know him, other than maybe his father. There's a couple other friends that know him. The struggle that was in his eyes tonight when we were having dinner and eating this carrot cake. Did you see this? The guy, I said, just take one bite. And he fought it so hard because I told you, as soon as we dropped him off, he would have ate the whole freaking carrot cake.
Have you ever done an eating competition?
I've not a competition, but
I'm fairly certain you would win.
Yeah.
Listen, Tom is ridiculous.
You finished your giant Reuben in I don't think 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, you have to attack it like an opponent, Nicole. That's the secret.
This is so great.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So you feel like you're an extremist.
I only have an on switch. There's no.
Maybe that's why you can't sleep.
Medium. Of course, that's why I can't sleep. I work 7 days a week, 365 days a year, from the time I get up to the time I go to bed.
So after MMA or after all of that, you have a restaurant.
The way my life went down is I was born and raised in Philadelphia till I was about 10. Uh-huh. And my parents, and I never used to talk a lot about this, but my parents ran a mission home. They used to take people off the streets of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
And I'll circle back to this and how it applies to my life today. And I never talked a lot about it because, you know, the brothers and sisters that I had, you only see them in movies. My brother Bobby Cummings, we used to go to prison and visit all the time, fell out of a tree and broke his neck and died robbing a house. You know, Don was overdosed in a warehouse.
These are your siblings?
Well, I consider them my siblings. Oh, these were people that just lived in our house with us and they ate at our table. And you know, my parents at the age of 9 gave my bedroom away to someone, their only biological son, and I slept in a bathtub for a year.
No shit.
Yeah. From 9 to 10, I had a third story. I was on the third floor of this house, and my bedroom was the bathroom because someone needed a bedroom that didn't have one. And so that was like the first part of my life, and I could talk to you hours about police taking people out of our house and little Joe who fell off a ledge and impaled himself on right through his leg. My dad had to pull him off. You know?
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I could just tell you story after story, and but that was normal. That was my normal. I mean, how many aces did I get from that? If you know anything about the Kaiser Permanente studies in the early 90s, the adverse childhood experience, I don't know how many aces I picked up there, but I don't really feel like I did. It was just my life. And, you know, but then my parents, who were both from Philadelphia, literally opened up a real estate magazine and pointed to Cooperstown, New York, and drove my mom and myself and in a van and bought a house for $32,000 in the early 80s. And my dad wanted to become a farmer. And he got like 2 chickens and a goose and a pony. We had 2 acres of land.
And they had cut out the mission. Like, they're no more with that.
No, they had a barn and they converted the barn into some apartments and had people shipped up from Philadelphia.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I could tell you some stories there too.
Wow.
Anyway, so my that as I got into middle school and high school, that was, you know, I never talked about it because, you know, we had people living in our barn, you know,
yeah.
And that was a little strange or different. And But then I really got into the sport of wrestling, and that just dominated my life. I was a horrendous student.
About what age did you start wrestling?
Well, I told you from the time I could walk, my dad and I wrestled.
But yeah,
I really, about the third grade, fourth grade, I found...
you got some organized...
Yeah, training. I found organized wrestling, and it really changed my life because I was a horrible student in school. And that's a whole nother story. You never met my academic equal, I promise you. I've been in front of over a million kids in the last 10 years, and I've yet to find my academic equal.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it combined 630 on my SATs. You probably got that on one half of your SATs.
We did ACTs, so I don't...
Oh, you did ACTs. Yeah. But, you know, 1600 is a perfect score. You know, most people get about 1,000, 1,200.
And you got what, 6?
Combined 630.
Oh, wow.
On the verbal. And
I got the lowest score that you could get to get into college on my ACT.
Okay. Well, I couldn't get into college. So, you know, I did very well wrestling in high school, and it...
Where'd you go to college?
Western New York, a school called Brockport. And but I got in under a special talent program. And it's a crazy story how I got in. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, it proves that there's cosmic forces in the universe, this story. And but anyway, I went to college.
So what happened? I mean, wasn't a normal scholarship or what?
Well, no.
Like, you were good at wrestling, but you were dumb.
So I was one of the top guys in the state of New York. I went to the state finals 37.
Hold on. Yeah. I want to talk about this because I know you very well. I jokingly say that you were a good wrestler, but you were dumb. But what would you equate this to? Or at what? You're not a dumb guy, clearly. You went on to college. You did well. I know you very well, the way you think. You've been very successful in business. So you're clearly not a dumb guy. But in high school, you didn't do well. Now, is it because you weren't applying yourself? Is it because you haven't discovered yourself?
Let me back you up to about the second grade in Philadelphia.
Okay.
The school, the system, I have very, very vague recollection of this. But the school system called my dad and said, your son is dyslexic. Okay. He's got some issues. Mm. And almost that day, my dad took me out of school and said... that just means that you can read backwards better than other people. He said, don't worry about it. The Jews do it. You'll be fine. That's a true story. If he was here, he'd tell you the same thing. And he homeschooled me until we moved to New York. And
this is so interesting.
Yeah, I didn't. And so, you know, there's a great book by a Dr. Maxwell Maltz, and a fascinating book written in the 60s called Psycho-Cybernetics. It's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, self-image is a funny thing because they say once it's programmed, you virtually cannot unprogram the self-image.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's impossible, almost. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to look at it is 96% of people that lose weight put it back on. Because Maltz would say you never see yourself any other way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, economics, they say, works the same way, that you will only be a degree or two wealthier, away from your parents' net worth your whole life. And it's impossible to, that means if your dad made 50 grand, maybe you'll make 100 grand someday. It's just a degree or two away. You'll never make 10 million. Because you just can't see yourself any other way. Your subconscious is programmed to see yourself, and you can't get out from underneath it. So the interesting thing about my journey academically was, from day one, I never had that file corrupted, if you think about it that way. And then when I moved to upstate New York, they tested me, and they said, your son's got some issues.
What age was this?
About the fourth grade.
Okay.
And they put me in a combination class, a special class for special kids. And my dad refused, and he said, there's nothing wrong with you. You just need to do fourth grade over again.
Mm.
And that was really what I needed more than anything. Like John Medina in his book, Attack of the Teenage Brain, talks about the dual systems model. Like, we look at a kid, and we can see that the kid's ready for certain sports, or like we can physically see their development. The brain works the same way. and we just don't see the brain. And we can't look at it and say, that brain's ready for this. My brain just wasn't ready for the age that I was at. And the best thing that ever happened to me was I got held back a year because it put me where I needed to be developmentally. So, you know, being held back a year did wonders for me. It didn't really help me tremendously. I've always had a difficult time reading out loud. It was a real problem for me as a kid. And I think that's when I really started to become a little self-aware of what was going on with me, but whatever. I didn't really care because I didn't have that early like label placed on me that I needed special help. And there's another great book called The Gift of Dyslexia. It's a wonderful book. And you find that most of the, or there a lot of very successful people have the same issue. And the funny thing about dyslexics are they figure out ways to do things.
Because they have
to. They have to. Their brain won't allow one of the things about me, and I don't like to brag, but I can figure just about anything out. Like if you give me some time and you allow me to work on something, like my brain doesn't shut off when it comes to figuring out something. It doesn't matter what it is. And I can remember being in fourth grade and like I would start counting the paragraphs like when you went around the room to read. I would count the paragraphs and I would read it in my head, right? Because I would have to be, I'd have to read it in my head because if I started to read out loud, my brain would get ahead of the words and I would stumble and people would laugh and it was very uncomfortable for me. But neither here nor there. I read one complete book in 4 years of high school. So not only did I probably have some kind of developmental issue, I never practiced. And nobody really ever made me practice.
But did you recognize it at the time or no?
I think a little bit of both. You know, I think I did start to understand just as I developed more self-awareness that I had some challenges.
So then how did you get from that into the special program for college then?
Well, it's funny. You know, I graduate and I go back to the story now. So I get through high school. The thing with wrestling and me, if you tell me I have to get a certain grade to wrestle, no problem. Like nothing will stop me from wrestling. My mindset was programmed to wrestle. And the way teachers would control me, because I was like every teacher's worst nightmare. Like hands down, that was me. And it wasn't that I was a bad kid. I just couldn't sit still. And I had a way of pushing buttons with people. I remember in the sixth grade, I had a...
Well, you're so smart.
Well, I don't know about that, but...
Well, come on.
But I had a... This is a funny story. I haven't told the story, and I can't even... I don't even know how long. It's funny. We're bringing back these memories that I haven't really thought about or talked about. I had this teacher. I probably shouldn't say his name, but he may not even be alive anymore. His name was George Babubalis. Like, that's a great name to
that's
have.
That's like a New York name.
Yeah, and he wasn't a very liked teacher, and... He wore leather. He rode a motorcycle. And everyone swore that he drank all day. I don't know. Because he would, after lunch, he would swish his scope and then he would just swallow it. Yeah.
Totally drank.
I don't know. Anyway, so it's a shame because I did like one, you know, every after lunch, you put your head on the table and he would, this was in the sixth grade, and he would read to you, which I loved. Like he read like The Hobbit and... He was a great orator, and that's how I learned best. But that doesn't, like, you're bringing back these memories, but this is a funny story. So in the sixth grade, when, like, I'm just getting ready to peak, or when that program is starting to run, you know, the one that makes you very disagreeable to people, and, you know, your parents especially, you know, that puberty hits. And I'm in sixth grade, and this guy, George Babubalis, wouldn't yell at you. And he... would have a clipboard on the side of his desk, and if you were disruptive or you did something, he would take the clipboard out, he'd look at you, and he would write, and he would put the clipboard back. So what did Tom Murphy do? So I would hang a clipboard on my desk. This is a true story. And when he did something I didn't like, this is a sixth grader, I would look at him and grab my clipboard and write it up, and I'd hang it back while I stared at him. Oh yeah, so I was a huge problem for teachers, and there were a few teachers that I owe a lot of a lot too, because mm-hmm. they gave me a safe space to cool down and
that's
to,
cool.
you know, and there's a couple of teachers I could tell you about. But, you know, I went through high school, struggled academically, got what I needed to get through school. And I was one of the best wrestlers at the time at my weight class in the state of New York. And
that's maybe, huge.
Oh, yeah. New York's a big wrestling state and maybe one of the top, you know, 25 kids in that weight class in the country at the time. And I thought for sure I'd go to college. And March, wrestling season was over. March comes around and nobody calls. Mm-hmm. Because at that time there were no computers. So you would have to have people come to your house, fill out an academic resume, you know, academics and your wrestling. And, you know, wow. they would send it out to schools and other schools would scout, you know, people. And I didn't have much of a name because I just kind of came out of nowhere my last year wrestling and did really well.
Wow.
And a guy came and filled out these things. And I thought for sure I'd get all kinds of offers. Nobody called. And it was mid-March and I can close my eyes and I can see the whole scene where my dad was working in Baltimore at the time, Coppin State, and my mom and I, and the wood stove was still going. That's how I can, you know, picture this.
Wow,
and
the phone rings.
Yeah, the phone rings and my mom goes, "Tommy, it's for you." And it was the State University of New York at Brockport. And a guy named Brian Quick, who's 2-time national champ and assistant coach. And he's like, "Hey, man, we're looking for someone in your weight class." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, this is my first pick, you know? So I wanna go." And this is a true story that my first day on campus was the first day of school. Never even visited the school.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
Yeah. So I end up going to Brockport, went in as special talent because I couldn't get in academically. Which means you got to have all these hoops you got to jump through, remedial classes. And
so they just recruited you just for wrestling instead?
Oh, yeah. But most schools don't do that because they, you know, you're going to waste a spot. Yeah. Like a kid that's going to fail out.
Going to fail out, you know? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But our coach was a very special way of dealing with young men like myself. And at 11 o'clock curfew the entire school year. No girlfriends on campus.
Well, what's your
the
coach
entire
name?
Coach Don Murray.
He's
an Olympic coach in the 70s. No girlfriends on campus the entire school year.
Wow.
No bars, no parties, the entire school year. You know, young men.
Old school.
Young men can become very destructive to themselves. Uh-huh. And they're their biggest problems. I mean,
uh-huh.
so are old men. You know, who are our biggest problems. But
oh,
so Coach Murray just had a zero tolerance. You know, these are the rules. Someone checked on you every night, came to your room. He called your room every year, every night. And so just anyway, so I end up going to Brockport and Coach Quick. And I don't think I ever saw a year where more than about 20 recruits would come in every year. And I think the most I ever saw graduate from one class was about 3 because, you know, the attrition rate is tough because there's so many rules.
Like, and so do you think you being extremist, like totally, that was good for you?
Perfect. It was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I don't do adventure races and stuff because uh-huh. like people are like, "Oh, let's go do this and have fun." And I'm like, not my thing. Like I'm doing it to win. I'm not doing it to have fun.
You're like, they're like shoving everyone down.
Oh, dude. You ask my
this
wife.
It's so funny because I don't know you that well.
You ask my wife. If Wendy were here, she would tell you. She won't play like board games with me.
That's what I was saying earlier, like, about him eating. You know, it's like
if I'm playing Candyland, I'm smashing my kids. Like, it's just go. That's I've gotten better over the years, but if Wendy were here, she would tell you she doesn't play board games with me because
oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's a sickness I have.
So then what? So you got
so I get to Brockport, and this is the whole long end of the story. Coach Quick, when I get there, he says, "If you make it your first semester, come and talk to me, and I'll tell you the only reason you're here," which was kind of, right? See the face you made? Kind of a funny thing to tell a struggling academic young man who probably isn't going to make it his first semester. But I make it through my first semester, and I went back to Quick, and I said, "Hey, man, what were you talking about?" And he said, "Oh, it was really funny." He said, "Last March, I was in charge of recruiting." And I'm like, "I know, you called me." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "One day Murray called me and said, you know, go over to my office." And Brockport's this flat wasteland. And in March, there's still snow and it's just an awful mm-hmm. walk. Like yeah. it's cold and the wind is
I got hard. To go. Remember you took me that one time. We spoke there.
Yeah. Yeah, you did. You went.
I got to go see your old wrestling room and everything. Yeah, that's met
right.
your coach.
That's right. That's
oh,
right.
That's
yeah, you, met us out. That. You met us out after.
That's
after
right.
After we spoke there.
It's crazy.
It was me, you, and Rick, I think.
Nah, Jason was there, but too.
Jason. And then we went out. We were eating wings or something, and yeah. he showed up.
Yeah, yeah, Coach yeah. Murray. Yeah. And so, but Quick says, he says, Murray calls me at 9 o'clock at night and says, go over to my office and get something. He forgot something. So Quick says, I put my stuff on, went over there. And he said, the wind was blowing, and I get over there, and Murray's office doesn't look like it's been touched since the 1970s. It looks like a Dr. Seuss novel, like books are piled up crooked.
Oh,
and,
that's cool.
Oh, yeah, like it's a disaster.
It's like an office.
Yeah. And so Quick says, I'm rummaging through the office looking for whatever he wanted me to look, get. He said, I couldn't find it, so I call him on the phone. And you don't call Murray for stuff like that because he's like, you dumb bastard, look, you know. Like, he just goes crazy.
Yeah.
And he just screams at him. He's like, look in the trash can. And Quick says, I start digging through the trash, and I find this piece of paper with a weight class that I'm looking for. He said, I take it out, fold it up, put it in my pocket. He said, a couple of days later, I was doing recruiting calls, and I remembered it was on my dresser. I went and got it. That piece of paper that those people came and filled out at my house.
No way. And it was
swear to God. And I tell kids all the time, I say, the only reason I'm standing here, look, I just got goosebumps thinking about this. The only reason I'm standing here, the only reason I'm sitting here with you two right now is because I came out of a trash can.
Wow.
Garbage. So when a kid tells me they're stupid, they can't do this, they're not good at that, I say, you're looking at garbage right here. Like, and then 4 years later, 3 years later, I graduated with almost a perfect GPA in philosophy.
Well, hold on.
He's an All-American.
Hold
Don't
on.
Me, you're All-American, right?
Two-time academic All-American.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, how about
so
that?
What did the coach say to you when you said after first semester or whatever, he said, you're going to find out why you're here?
Because he was like, it's
oh, that
a funny
was the story.
That was the story. That he pulled my piece of paper out of a garbage.
What did you say to him when he told you
like,
that?
I didn't know what to say.
How
did
he
like,
say?
Like,
yeah, I can't imagine.
Cool,
you
know. What do I do now? What's
yeah,
next
and
step?
I still didn't believe that I could make it academically.
Yeah.
Right? Because my first semester was really easy because I was in like remedial reading and remedial writing.
You're in high school classes.
Like,
too,
not even.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
it was
like
for really dumb people.
Yeah.
And
so then, I mean, we could talk about so many things, but yeah. Orlando mentioned speaking. So you do Sweetheart and Heroes. Am I saying that right?
Sweethearts,
Sweethearts.
S plural.
Okay.
And Heroes, plural.
Okay. Sweethearts and Heroes.
Yeah.
What is it? Why did you start it?
Go. Well, the
this is incredible, you guys. I really want you guys to pay attention to this because
well,
it's incredible.
So, you know, I have to tell people it started in Philadelphia and I didn't realize it. You know, the empathy that my parents had for people, and I said this once on the video and I can see myself saying this, boggles my mind because I just don't know why they brought, cause these weren't, my parents didn't get money. It was not like a state house. It was different churches and people that they knew that just like, I don't know why my parents didn't grow up this way. Like they grew up, you know, Catholic, you know, organized, you know, blue collar Philadelphia people. And for some reason they just started taking people in and, you know, and I was around people that epitomized hopelessness. Like at the end of their rope, the only other place they could go was death. Like there's no other option for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the people that lived with us. And that's kind of a weird way to say it, and probably not the best way to say it, but there were no options.
Yeah.
And my parents, these people just ate at our table. And we had dinner every night at a table, hard to believe. And so that's when it started. And, you know, I didn't really realize it then, the programming that was taking place to my mind. And, you know, as I grew up, you know, obviously I became very self-absorbed in wrestling and, you know, that was my life. And I found a fascination in psychology, not because I wanted to be a psychologist, because I think I just had this desire to understand people. You know, I really got into philosophy, which was fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that just started my, you know, different, like, it just wired my brain neurologically to look at certain things. And
it's been alive for how long? How long has it been around?
Sweethearts and Heroes? Mm-hmm. Oh, 10 years now. But then as I went through college, the greatest part of my mixed martial arts career, which we didn't really touch on, because after college, I, you know, got to compete on one of the biggest stages in the world, which I don't really love talking about. Mm-hmm. I love to talk about are the people, the coaches that had an impact on me, and right. the stories and the lessons that I got. You know, I can talk about my relationship with a guy named George St. Pierre, who's one of the greatest champions in UFC history. Mm-hmm. And I tell kids all the time, I say, he's not a champion because of what he did in the ring. I say, George was a champion because he would come into the gym, there'd be 50 guys ready to train. He's going to do 5 rounds. That's it. And if you're lucky to be one of the 5 people that gets to work with him, that's an amazing feat. And every week I was one of these guys that got to do a round with him, round with him. And, but the neat thing about George is he would go around when he came in the gym and shake everyone's hand, a guy who's making 6 figures a fight. And when he was done training and everybody was leaving, he's still working out. And I used to hang out and work out with him after practice. But then he would shake everybody's hand and thank them for being there. Like, that's what makes a champion. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the people I had the opportunity to train with. And to me, the lessons, you know, spiritually, physically, metaphysically, that I got from some of these people I got to train with, I found myself about 11, 12 years ago just talking to kids. Like little things, like on leadership, goal setting,
at
motivation.
Your gym, or
I think it started at my gym, but then I found like different schools and guys that I wrestled with, and like, oh, can you come talk to my team? And I'm like, yeah, okay. I can go do
because originally, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, you naturally had the knack to speak in front of people. For one, it's not just the knack. You've practiced it. I've seen you evolve. You've gotten better. You put in a lot of effort. It's not just the knack. But the fact that you had the background, the athletic background, you had the show, you know, whether you liked it or not, you had the show, you fought in the UFC. People wanted you to originally just come and talk because you were a professional athlete, you were in the professional world, and you were a draw, and kids would listen to you.
I had a neat hook.
But you took it, instead of just showing up as an ex-fighter and talking and telling kids, hey, listen, you could have, that was a good enough story, what you just told us, and that would have a lot of inspiration in it and would help a lot of kids. That would have been cool enough in itself, but instead you took advantage of it and you started to create what's now Sweethearts and Heroes.
Yeah.
Which is like, just say real quick, like, what is it? So people know what it is.
So if I had to summarize it into 2 quick statements, I would say it's about, and this is hours worth of discussion. Mm-hmm. It has to do with student empowerment, mm-hmm. not quite the way you're thinking, and empathy activation. Mm-hmm. That's really what, after 10 years, the heart of our message. And when I say student empowerment, I don't mean empowering you to be more confident. Mm-hmm. Like, that's almost an impossible task, mm-hmm. for me to go into a school and to be like, oh, you can do it. And by 3rd period, you'll be humiliated again. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not realistic to go into a school to pump a kid up and think that they can just change the fact that they sleep on a trailer floor, that their mom's a junkie, that her boyfriend's a jerk, you know, and you have no friends and you smell like cat pee. And I'm not going to change that. Mm-hmm. But you know who can change that? The kids that you see every single day. And really, we used to call ourselves a bystander empowerment group. Mm-hmm. Like, my job is to activate the other young people. Because let's be frank, when a kid's treated negatively, 96% to 97% of the time, that behavior's always gotten away with. Nobody sees it. Mm-hmm. It just, but 85% of the time, there's someone present when someone's not being treated the right way. Mm-hmm. And you can look back into your past and almost close your eyes and remember situations where people did things and said things and treated people certain ways. And like a movie, you can almost play it back in your mind. Mm-hmm. And what did you do?
Nothing.
Not too much.
Froze.
And we know why. And this is really the heart of our message is, you know, to take you into what sweethearts and what heroes are, because it's kind of a weird name. Sometimes people like hearts and heroes. What is it? And
I think it's cool.
But there's reasons.
Hold on. Yeah. Finish that.
I will. But there's reasons that kids don't jump into action. And we really, truly have identified why. And, you know, our system, I don't call it a program, but our system that we employ in schools and, you know, other environments, really understands why kids don't do what we call jump into action. Because that's the idiom that every kid knows. If I walk into an auditorium, I say, jump into, they'll finish it because they know that idiom. And that's what superheroes do. They jump into action. And there's two reasons why kids don't jump into action. Number one, they feel silly or ridiculous, right? Like, but you didn't realize that's why superheroes wear tights, right? Like, they don't need to put tights on to run to public, but they do. Because why? Because vulnerability is tough. And really, it comes down to vulnerability. We're wired as humans not to make ourselves vulnerable, right? And especially in those middle school years when that crazy little program's running, when you got to look awesome in front of people, right? And your hair's got to be big and your or whatever. Vulnerability is tough for a young person. It's tough for a human. And you can't expect a kid just to go help a kid that smells like cat pee that everybody's making fun of, whose dad's in jail. Like, no, that's not realistic. So we do a lot on vulnerability. And number one thing you have to do with vulnerability is understand what it is. And I love asking people all the time. I say, what's the first thing you think of when I say vulnerability? One word.
Scared.
Vulnerability.
Weak.
All right. So you both hit the nail on the head. When I do that in the classroom, 90% of teachers, students will say something like you just said. Weak. Right? Now check this out. Your daughter is 7 now. I know you don't want to picture that yet. But she's 7, 8 years old. And she decides, Mommy, I'm going to do the talent show. And I'm going to sing a song. And she practices for about 2 weeks with you in the living room. Right? And then it comes time for the song. And she gets her little recorder and she brings it up on stage. And all the parents are there. And your little heart's going, right? And you can almost feel it. And she gets up there and her little heart's racing. She's making herself vulnerable. Yeah. Now, Orlando, are you going to tell me your daughter's weak?
No, of course.
Okay, that's what you just associated with vulnerability.
Because the feeling that you feel when you're vulnerable.
Right. So, yeah. But truly, honestly, vulnerability is strength. Yeah. And when a kid truly understands the empowerment of making oneself vulnerable, opening yourself up to attack emotionally, physically, and getting through that, what can't you do once you understand that vulnerability is strength? And so, you know, that's a lot of some of the work that we do with kids. That's the first reason kids don't jump into action. But truly, honestly, and I used to say the real reason they don't jump into action, but vulnerability is a real reason.
Yeah.
But the real reason kids don't jump into action, we've never really taught them what to do.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, if I were to say to you, what do you do? When you see someone, or what do you do when you catch on fire?
Stop dropping
that. Have you ever met a single human that's ever used that?
No.
Isn't that the craziest thing that we've taught 50 million public school kids what to do when they never
catch on fire? Wow.
Like, think about that.
Yeah, that's
like,
crazy.
Like, think about what else you learned in school that you'll never use. Oh. That always makes kids laugh in front of teachers, so you gotta be careful when you say that. But the truth is, like, you know why stop, drop, and roll works? Because it's simple, it's action-based, and it's life-saving. And that's the formula, simple, action-based, life-saving. That's why it works, right? Just like a fire drill. You never really used a fire drill before for real, but you grew up doing them.
So what do you teach your kids? What is the...
We teach them a simple, action-based, life-saving plan. You know where I got it from? Superhero school.
Oh, you're so good. Yeah, okay, so off of that, so the first time I met you, you had your nails painted, and I didn't know anything. Let me just finish that.
Yeah. Let me just finish that. No, that's okay.
This is all so good.
And I won't go into it because the system is, I don't want to say it's long and arduous because it's not. It's very simple. But we give kids real superpowers, like that are simple, action-based, and life-saving. I'll just give you one. So I told you I learned it in superhero school, and I always start with the starter pack of superpowers. Like, what? Think of any superhero in your head that you want to right now.
That what? Right?
Think of any superhero in your head that you want to right now.
Okay.
All right? All of them have three superpowers, and they all have this first one. This is the first thing every superhero does when someone's in danger, right?
Mm-hmm.
When someone's in danger, the superhero flies in and takes the person
out of the situation.
Away.
Away.
Oh, right? Okay. Because
I say it's as simple as the ABCs.
Okay.
A is away.
Okay.
Now think about this. Imagine the next time you saw someone treating this girl. And by the way, what was the name of the girl in high school, her first name when you were in school? I'm serious. Like, what was her name? The one that was too heavy, didn't have a lot of friends.
Yeah.
You remember her first name?
You had one, I bet.
Like, you're asking me honestly?
Yeah, for sure. Heather. Heather, right? You probably didn't do much for Heather when people were making fun of her, laughing at her. But imagine if you practiced, right?
Uh-huh.
Flying in when somebody just started treating Heather the wrong way. And you said, oh, Heather, can you show me where the principal is? Oh, could you show me where they keep the pens here? Can you help me put these balls out on the field?
Uh-huh.
Right? Imagine if you did that and you took her
away,
right? So that's a superpower. It's what every superhero does.
Wow.
They jump into action. Now, here's the key. We say peers intervene less than 10% of the time. Most studies say they jump into action about 4% of the time and help kids that are different,
uh-huh.
right? But if a student, if a hero jumps into action within the first 10 seconds, that's mm-hmm. the moment, mm-hmm. right? It's a magic window. They can be successful over 60% of the time. So you can go from about 4% to a 60% success rate by just walking up to a kid and saying, oh man, could you help me do this? Or could you show me where this is?
Uh-huh.
So it's simple, it's action-based, it's life-saving.
Uh-huh.
So it's the same formula. So two reasons kids don't jump into action, vulnerability.
Uh-huh.
Vulnerability takes practice, right? You gotta do things over and over again.
Uh-huh.
Spaced, repetitive practice.
Uh-huh.
And number two, you got to give them a strategy. Life isn't a talent contest. It's a strategy game.
Mm-hmm.
So kids have to have strategies, real strategies. And as a parent, you know what? We give some of the worst advice. Like, I talk to parents all the time, and moms are like, oh, yeah, I tell my kid to stick up for those kids that are different all the time. And I always say to moms or dads, I say, well, when was the last time they saw you do that?
Yeah.
And they're usually like, oh, well, we volunteer Christmas Eve at the food shelf. And I'm usually like, all day.
Yeah.
And but the reality is we tell kids to stick up for kids that are different. But try that with math sometime. Say, what do you mean? Say, what do you mean?
What do you mean?
So, like, imagine if I explained a math problem to you one time. Like, you're a little kid, and I explain it to you. Hey, Nicole, A plus B equals X, Y, Z. Okay, I just explained it to you one time. Good luck. I'll see you at the test.
Yeah.
Does that sound ridiculous?
100% ridiculous.
Right. Now, how much more ridiculous is it to say to a kid, hey, next time you see someone treating Joey the wrong way, you know, the guy that smells like cat pee, oh, make sure you do something for him. Okay, good luck with that. You're going to send this little kid into a socially charged situation. He or she has never practiced once, and you think they're going to get it right?
Yeah.
Who's freaking crazy?
Yeah.
You are. Like, kids have no idea what to do, and you think they're just going to get it right?
This is the first time I've ever heard anyone talk about teaching vulnerability.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to teach it.
You have to.
Incredible.
But you have to practice it.
Well, hold on now.
Practice it, for sure.
So, anyway.
So, help me understand this, because from what I know, and you mentioned it earlier. Now, first off, just now you mentioned a stat. You said something that only about... Is it 10% of peers intervene?
Less than 10% actually intervene when someone's being treated the wrong way.
Okay, now I know you. Now I know for a fact, and you mentioned it earlier, that you used to, when she asked what Sweethearts and Heroes was, you said, well, you used to call yourself an organization that focused on the bystander.
Yeah.
Now, there's a good quote. I know you can quote that the world is not evil because of evil people or something to this nature.
It's Einstein.
Evil because of the people that do nothing about it, right? Yep. Einstein. And that's what I know of Sweethearts and Heroes. But you said it shifted some, or you don't focus on the bystander as much anymore. You do.
Well, so I think we do, and I think there's a little semantic game that's being played by us. But I think once you start to label anybody, you know, I don't even like to call kids victims anymore. Like, when you just label someone as a victim, I tell parents victimize their kids all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, if your daughter comes home and you start, you know, she comes home upset and you're like, Orlando, you would never believe, you know, she said that this other little girl, you know, and then you call the school. And meanwhile, she's sitting there playing with her blocks.
Right.
And then you call your mom. And you say, you're not going to believe what happened today. And then your sister comes over for a glass of wine. Like, why wouldn't your daughter play that role eventually?
Mm.
So I'm very careful not to just call a kid a victim. I say, you may be been someone's target, but you certainly don't need to play that victim.
Yeah.
And that's all, like I already said, it's really tough to change a kid's perception of themselves when they've spent years playing the victim or actually being the victim.
Yeah.
So I've just really even semantically tried to change, you know, like I'm about student empowerment, not just the bystander, like total student empowerment. So,
well, listen, I know you just asked him about his nails because his nails, I know we don't have any video here, but people who meet Tom and see pictures of Tom, you have all five of them painted typically now? They all have a different...
Yeah, there's one that usually isn't. They're so kind of jacked up right now.
So that'll say a little bit more about Tom. But before we go on, we're going to take a quick break here from our sponsors. We will come right back and talk a little more. We will let you know where to find Tom when we're done. But just in case we forget, it's definitely Sweethearts and Heroes. Where else, Tom?
Facebook,
but Google Sweethearts and Heroes. There's Instagram. You guys are on Instagram. Is it Sweethearts and Heroes on Instagram as well? And listen, if you're enjoying our podcast, we really plan on putting in some more work. We plan on growing. But if you're enjoying what you're listening to, please let us know. Please share it with everyone. And if you know anyone that you think would be great for other people to listen to, or you have any great ideas, please share them with us because we're really starting to get into this. And we want to make sure we're not just doing it only for ourselves. We hope a few of you are enjoying it. So a quick word from our sponsors, and then we will get back to understand the meaning of all of Tom's fingernails. Paintings? Is that what do you call it? Fingernail paintings. Here we come.
Okay, so the first time I met you, we were sitting at Del Frisco's Grill, and you had your nails painted. And I had kind of known about Sweethearts and Heroes. It was Shots of Legacy when I lived in
Oregon. Oh, that's right. With the short line show up in Grapevine. Yeah. Okay.
And so I was like, why are your fingernails painted? And I was not expecting the response that you gave.
What did I say?
You did your whole bit about...
I did the whole bit?
Yeah, the whole bit. And I was like,
usually I say, because I'm a superhero, that's my quick response.
I think you said that, but I was like, and?
And, yeah.
She didn't know anything about
that. And then I usually say, because I don't believe in telling kids what to do.
And then it went on from there, so.
Well, it's tough to, without seeing them, I actually ordered some nail polish tonight because I'm just about out.
So your thumbs. So you keep your thumbs red for everybody listening. You keep your thumb red.
I'll tell you. So I'll do a quick story.
Okay, it takes me an hour. Give us all the fingers and colors.
I will. Just hold on.
Give us a little tease.
So, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. 6 years, my fingernails have been painted.
Okay, so put into retrospect. How tall are you?
Maybe 6'2".
How much do you weigh?
230.
And he walks around with his fingernails painted. Yeah. And you would never think that his response would be like he helps middle school children. Is that right? Middle school?
Oh, K-12 now. K-12. I prefer doing elementary now, but
yeah,
you don't teach a middle school or a high school kid a fire drill.
It's true. Yeah.
You teach them when they're this big.
Yeah.
So you can't truly change a culture by trying to teach high school kids.
Yeah.
I mean, you can affect some.
Uh-huh.
And that's why the old advertisers, Philip Morris and all them, they used to advertise to the elementary kids.
Yeah. So anyway, it was funny, Orlando. I don't know if you really know this, but I had the day I left Rail America, was the day I painted my fingernails for the first time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you didn't know that.
No.
Yeah, that's how I can mark it. So I had left the company, and I was with them for 15, 16 years. And my daughter had to go driver's ed. And I walk in, and I sat in the back, and I was just in a daze. I mean, I had hired 40 men there, a couple women, but mostly men. And I started this with three people, and when I left, I had 40. One railroad and over 50. It was my baby. And certainly the people there were the ones that created the greatness of the center, but I had the privilege of putting each brick in place. So it was a big change for my life, and I didn't know what was next. I was speaking to kids, but not at the level I am today. But I was sitting in the back of the room, and my head was in this daze, and there's this thing called Red Thumb Reminder that started a year or two before. And the lady's like, does anybody want to paint their thumbnails red? Because that's the ones that you text with typically.
This was so, in driver's ed.
Driver's
class.
Ed. My daughter's driver's ed.
They're trying to teach them not to, to text.
Just remind
drive.
You that when you touch your phone, you could kill someone.
Amen.
11 kids die every day because people text and drive. So this is mean stop. And without thinking, I just stood up and walked to the front and, painted my thumbnails, and all the other parents were like, ooh, hee hee, you know, Tom Murphy. And and I went home with those painted red, and I had this epiphany that it really wasn't about Red Thumb Reminder.
Now, what makes you do these things?
Now, hold on, let me just finish this one, and then you can answer that or ask that. But I had this epiphany that it really wasn't about texting and driving. Like when you got your license, your parents today would tell you two things. They would say, don't
drink and drive,
and don't
text and drive,
right? That's what they, and I talk to kids about this all the time, and I say, those are the two things your parents are going to tell you. And then I look out over this room of kids, and I say, now don't throw your parents under the bus here. I said, but how many of your parents do you see texting and driving, or saying, oh, let me just type this. Okay, okay, I'm done.
Real quick.
And kids will giggle, and some kids will shoot their hands up, and half the kids will be able to say, oh, yeah, my parents do that. And they tell you not to do it, right? That's horrible leadership. Like, you can't tell a kid to do one thing and you do the opposite. That's horrible parenting. It's horrible leadership. It's the first principle of leadership. This is the way I frame it to the kids that are in middle or high school. I said, you're all at the age where you're probably messing around with vaping or cigarettes. And like, I'm not telling you not to. Like, that's the difference between me and your parents. I'm not your parents. I'm just going to tell you, I don't think it's real healthy. But I'm not going to tell you not to. You're at that age. But here's the way that you frame it to a young person. All of you that are screwing with cigarettes, anybody in here got little brothers or sisters? And kids will put their hands up, and I'll walk over to them, and I'll say, okay, I want you to go home and take one of your cigarettes and go to your little 7-year-old sister. Oh, you want one? No, here, have one. And the kid will look at you like you're crazy, right? I say, well, when she finds your cigarettes in your room, I'm going to tell you what you're going to say. You're going to say to her, you have no idea what stress I'm going through right now. Mom and Dad are going to get divorced, and you have no idea, and this is just, no, don't do that to her. Just give her a cigarette and have one with her. Because she's watching you do something, but you're going to tell her not to do it. Like, that's bad leadership. So I realized that this Red Thumb Reminder wasn't just about texting and driving. It's about all the little things that we tell people to do, but we do the opposite. And you got to think deeply. You got to take an inventory as a parent, how many things you tell your kid not to do, but you do the opposite. Like, kids are going to just do what you do.
100%.
It doesn't matter what you tell them.
Yeah.
Like, forget about telling kids things. It doesn't work. Their brain isn't designed for that yet. The mirror neurons in there.
So is that why you do these things? I mean, back to my question
earlier.
All of
these fingernails are painted for one reason. They're behaviors that I choose to model to kids.
No, but I'm asking on a deeper level. I get that. Not just me, because I know you, but... Why do you do it? Okay, they model behavior to kids, but are you doing this because it makes you feel better? Are you doing this because you're thinking about your kids and you want to be an example, like you were just talking about as a parent? What really drives you to do these things?
Well, I think you're asking a deeper question of why do I do Sweethearts and Heroes, and why have I, you know, given my life to it?
Yeah,
because exactly. I'm not making a fortune doing it. I certainly made a heck of a lot more money working in the corporate world than speaking to kids. You know, I always tell people there's really a couple things. Number one, I have kids of my own, and some of the heart-wrenching stories I could bring both of you to tears with right now over the hopelessness that I've seen in this generation. And just don't forget this, that the number one thing to take the life of a 10 to 14 year old in North America today are their own hands. Mm-hmm. Never before seen in history. Mm-hmm. And people say why, and you can summarize it into one word. And if you took the time to watch 13 Reasons Why a couple years ago, you'd feel the word. If you took the time to understand why 22 service members take their own life every day in this country, it's because they feel hopeless. Mm-hmm. Right?
Is it the suicide 11, I think, is the number right now? Suicide, what you're talking about? Suicide, teenage suicides at 11 a day or something?
Yeah. Well, I think I just read yesterday 3,041 9th through 12th graders attempt every day.
Come on.
Yeah, 3,041 attempt every day. And, and I don't want to get too far off track here.
Right.
You know, so when I talk to kids, because people say we're a bullying organization, nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I talk to bullying; it's the horse that we ride in on a lot, because schools need to address that. Uh-huh. But we're at war, Nicole.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know if you took the time a couple years ago to watch Caitlin Nicole Davis from Cedar Creek, Georgia, as she live streamed her own suicide at the age of 12.
Yeah.
What?
And I mean, I watched the whole 40 minutes, and it's a tough thing to watch. And I remember when my partner Jason called me and he said, "Hey, I'm sending you a link, you gotta watch this." And I was like, "No way. Like, I'll never watch that. I have kids that age." And he said, "We're at war. We're at war with this thing called hopelessness. And we have a generation of young people that feel more hopeless than ever before in Western history. And we're not asking why. And we better start." And I think it was Nelson Mandela said, if you truly, the sign of any culture, I forget how he words it, but the true distinction or destiny of a culture is what they do to their children. Mm. And what are we doing to our children? You know, why do they feel so hopeless? Why is the number one thing to take the life of a middle schooler suicide today? And
I love that acronym that you use. You keep using the word hopelessness, and it's always it's still to this day is one of my favorite acronyms to tell people is hope. Share that with everybody.
Yeah, hold on, possibilities exist.
One of my favorite acronyms to tell someone when I know someone's struggling.
Yeah.
I love to share that acronym with them. That way, anytime I see them on the slide, on the chill, where they don't know what. Everyone else in the room didn't know what I can just look at them and say, "Hey, keep that hope." And I can say it very passively. Yeah. I can say it very, I can just say it fun. And no one else in the room knows what I'm talking about. But that person who has shared with me that they're having problems and I've shared that acronym with them, we have, you know what I mean? It's like a little code word where I'm able to tell them from across the room, "Hey, I got your back." But no one else has to know that you're struggling. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's one of the favorite things that you've ever shared with me.
So why?
So you know, when I, you know, I go off on these tangents and, you know, when I think about my own kids, I can't imagine them going through what thousands of kids that I've talked to over the last 10 years go through. Mm-hmm. Like, I just can't imagine. And, you know, how dare I ask a kid to jump into action and help another kid when I have the ability to do it and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple years ago, you know, I was at a crossroads in my life, and I just said, you know, how dare I tell a kid to jump into action and give them these strategies? And I have just as big an opportunity to do it on a giant scale and teach kids how to change or save the lives of other kids. And how dare I not do it? And so I think one of the main reasons I do it is because I have kids and I understand. Like, I can't imagine losing one of my own kids to hopelessness. And, you know, I think number two, and I've lived by this kind of mantra my, you know, last 10 or 15 years of my life, I always tell kids, I say, "You're all going to be on the big stage someday, you know, and you're going to be in your coffin, hopefully years from now, You know, it's inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. There's no need to shy away from that. And you know who's going to show up? Like, no one's going to show up and be like, oh, my God, Orlando had a giant house.
Yeah.
What a car that guy had. I mean, like, the only people that are going to show up are the people whose life you've affected in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And if you're not living your every day thinking about that, you miss the point of life. And most people never get out of that aesthetic stage. I think it was, I'm a big Søren Kierkegaard fan, whether you like his stuff or not. You know, he's a Danish philosopher and, you know, fascinating guy. And, you know, he says that, you know, mostly he has the three phases of life. And he says most people never get out of the aesthetic. You know, you got to get your house and have your friends. And like most people stay there their whole life. And you know, I think that towards midlife, people naturally get into what he would call the ethical stage. You know, where you start having these deeper thoughts and questions. And that's where most people stall out. Mm-hmm. Like, they start to scratch that metaphysical aspect of life, and they, but I really try and remind myself on a daily basis that, like, that's the whole point of life is relationships. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing else. Mm-hmm. Like, we are wired as humans to crave human acceptance. Yeah. Like, when you isolate a human for 3 days, there's measurable amounts of brain damage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the central themes of all of Nietzsche's work was, you know, solitude, and we're all trying to run from being alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to get, like, too crazy, like, philosophical here, but that's what I think about. I think about my own kids and hopelessness. I think about the fact that I have the ability to help kids understand jumping into action and mm-hmm. how to do it the right way and why they don't do it. How dare I not do that? And
so do you wear your free hug shirt when you go?
I've been in this shirt, Nicole, for over 3 years. I wear no other shirt every day. You'll never see me in another shirt. Maybe if I'm in the gym, I don't like to sweat in these. But every day of my life, I wear one of these shirts.
And people come up. I was with you last time you were here. Yeah. Some, like, two people came up and gave you a hug.
Yeah, it happens.
So shirt, for people, you'll see it. If you look up Sweethearts and Heroes, you look up Tom Murphy, you'll see it. But a shirt that he always wears, he's talking about the black t-shirt in pink letters. On the front, it says free hugs. And on the back, has it changed any, or it just says, it says oxytocin?
Squeeze for oxytocin.
Squeeze for oxytocin, that's right, which is always controversial, because I've witnessed on multiple occasions where people think it says squeeze for Oxycontin.
And they get mad. I've had people yell at me.
Because they don't pay attention to what it says. Yeah. Half of them don't know what oxytocin is. Yeah. Unfortunately, they do know what Oxycontin is.
Yeah.
And because when everything's lined perfect.
Have you always been a great hug giver? You give good hugs.
I practice a lot.
Were you one of those, like, air touch hugs before?
No.
I hate air touch. Like, don't air
hug me. I'm so fake, right?
It's like, it's or genuine. Don't even, like, kind of have it. Like, you hug, when you're gonna, if you're gonna hug someone, you're gonna hug somebody.
I go big. Yeah. I got different techniques for different
things. It's always people. The hardest thing for me. It's like, when I hug Nicole, I grab her ass, right? Like, when I hug Nicole, I give her a good...
It's not part of my hug sequence.
But it's weird, but, you know, it's because it's so... I love her so much and I care. So when I hug other people that I really care about, it's hard for me.
The last time I saw naturally, you, I was super pregnant. And you're like, I haven't hugged a pregnant woman in a really long time.
When you saw Tom.
Crazy neurochemicals that fire when you do that.
That was weird.
What?
Oh, weird.
So I won't go into all of these.
Yeah,
but so you wanted to mention them all. I mean,
the at least mention, if you don't want to go into depth, but at least mention what they are.
Right. So the pointer finger is the red thumb reminder. There's only a little bit on there right now, but it's, like I said, the most deadly finger on your hand, because it's the one that you
pull the trigger with.
The one that you hit send with, right?
Okay.
And as a leader, these are all leadership lessons. Modeling lessons, and as a leader, it's really easy for you to take your phone and tell someone, if you don't blah blah blah, and you blast them, like, that's a horrible thing to do to someone when you have, they have zero control over what you write or what you say in a message. Like, don't ever do that as a leader. Mm-hmm. I have a big long thing on it. These two are usually green. There's a little bit of green on them. Mm-hmm. Green's the color of hope, and when you cross your fingers, when you hope for something, you cross your fingers.
Yeah. Right?
And my job is to, like, I see kids all the time, and they say, "Oh my God, Mr. Murphy, I gave hope to my best friend Natalie. She was really struggling." And I always say, "That's great, you know, but what about that girl Lisa? Ooh, gross. Well, Lisa probably needs hope more than anybody." So my job as a leader and is to model how to give hope to even the toughest people. Like, that's a really challenging thing to do. And you were taught the wrong way as a kid. When you were walking down the street and your mom was holding your hands and here comes that homeless guy, she probably was like, "Oh, honey, let's go to the other side of the street."
Yeah.
Like, and then she sent you to school and told you to stick up for people that were different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how we learned to give hope to people, right? Mm-hmm. mail them a check or show up at the soup kitchen. And So the little piggy here is supposed to be gold. And, you know, the little piggy did what all the way home?
Wee.
Cried all the way home. Mm-hmm. And those are for the two core things that humans need. You know, I told you we need food, shelter, and water to live.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, you have a need for two things. And we talked about this a little bit at dinner.
Yeah, we did.
You have a need for meaning or purpose in your life. And mm-hmm. my job is, whenever I'm in charge of someone or leading a group, my job is to find meaning for everyone. Really easy to take the kid that can throw the ball really far and find meaning right there.
Mm-hmm.
But what about that kid that, like, has his head against the wall and he refuses to change his clothes and he hates phys ed class? Like, how do you find meaning for that kid?
Right.
Yeah.
But when you can get him to see that, oh my God, man. And I tell teachers this all the time. They make kids participate. And I say, whoa, slow down. I said, you know, some people, their job is to be the watcher. Like, some people watch basketball.
Mm.
Like, that's what they do. Like, maybe he just needs to start out and being the watcher.
Because you're giving him a purpose.
I'm giving him a purpose.
Oh, my God, that's
like,
so
we
great.
We need you, man, to be the, like, we don't have anybody else to watch this. Like, when I do, we have these patented things we call bully drills.
Uh-huh.
I won't go into it right now with you, but some kids just don't want to participate. Vulnerability, fear, and anxiety, some tough things, and just... And, you know, when they don't want to participate, teachers, inevitably, a lot of them make them. And I say, whoa, we need a watcher. Hey, man, can you hold the timer for me? And I just give them a job, right? And
they're, like, actually participating.
And if you pay attention to your daughter when she comes home from school, my buddy Rick, who I speak with, picked up on this because I talk about it all the time. He said, it was amazing. My daughter's really good, loves phys ed, loves math. He said, but she comes home every day from school and she's like, Dad, I was the chair stacker today.
Oh.
Like, that was her purpose. That was her meaning.
Yeah.
You got to celebrate that. Not like, let me see your math paper. Like, no. Like, her purpose that day
was excited about it.
Chair stacker. You got to celebrate that.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing that everyone needs, especially the little piggy, right? That's on the outside. And the other thing is human acceptance. And I already briefly mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
But my job is to get it. Now, it's really, this is a tricky one because we always say, I can't make kids accept other kids.
Mm-hmm.
But they can watch me accept other kids.
Mm-hmm.
They can watch me accept really challenging peak kids. Like, even that kid, like, I tell teachers to be really careful because, like, that kid that always shows up late, just doing this in the classroom.
Yeah.
You know, can everyone please sit down? Everyone. And then you kind of like look at that kid. You know what you just told every kid in that class? You got the right to treat that kid any way you want because you're the leader.
Yeah.
And now you're going to treat that kid like the little piggy on the outside.
Yeah.
So significance and acceptance are two of the core things that our message revolves around. And that's the little piggy. And this is my forgiveness finger.
Mm-hmm.
The middle finger. Yeah. And, the one finger salute.
You know, we all learn to forgive the wrong way. And I had to relearn this myself. When you were a little girl, your mom looked at you and she said, say you're sorry.
Yeah.
Look at him now and say you're sorry. We're not going on with this interview until you turn your head and look at Orlando and say, I'm not laughing, young lady. Say it.
How comfortable is that?
Now.
This is so funny.
You better say it.
Oh, you're actually wanting me to say it. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Hey, and mean it.
Yeah.
How many times did you hear that one, right?
Oh, my God.
That's crazy stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
You'll do that to your daughter. And it was innocent when it happened. You were on the playground. You knocked someone over accidentally. Your mom picked up the other kid and said, oh, my God, sweetie, say you're sorry. Mm. Like, it was innocent. And then it turned into that disaster where she was screaming at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell dads, I say, here's a better idea. The next time you come home from work and your car's breaking down and your boss is a jerk and you got bills to pay and you're stressed out and you're in a fight with your wife and it's probably your fault. And you walk in the door and there's your 13-year-old sitting on the couch screwing with her phone. And you just go, ugh. And you go in the kitchen and there's just dishes coming out the sink. You make a beeline for that living room. And you get right in her face and you say, I told you the next time I come home and those dishes aren't done, get in there. And you throw her in the kitchen and she puts her earbuds in and, you know, starts slamming the dishes in the dishwasher. And you jump on the couch and turn the TV on. And here's a story of a guy that went to Iraq and got blown to heck, lost his ears, lost his nose, lost his leg. Here's what you'll do every time, Dad. Whew. Man, my life ain't that bad.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's the moment you go back in that kitchen where you call your daughter back in the living room. And when she comes in, she's going to be burning holes in you with her laser beams.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what you say to her. Hey, I'm sorry for being a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't say but.
Yeah.
Just say sorry. You were a friggin' jerk.
Yeah.
You know what that's going to do? The next time she gets in a fight with her best friend, who probably screwed up, but your daughter was failing a test or a fight with you and your daughter just lets her have it because she can. You know what she'll be able to do the next time she calms down? She'll be able to look at her best friend and say, hey, I'm really sorry for the way I treated you.
Mm-hmm.
I was frustrated. I'm sorry, because she saw you do it. And that's the way we should teach kids how to forgive.
Yeah, that's so powerful.
They should see us do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the last one's the white one. And that's my commitment finger. And we started some of this discussion teasing me about my extreme kind of. But I don't think there's much more important than commitment in life.
Yeah.
And whether it's to your wife, whether it's to your children, whether it's to your purpose.
Or to your hobbies or whatever.
Right.
You stay committed to
it. Like, you got to be.
Yeah.
I have this Truman quote. It's been on my phone for, I can't even remember how long now. Mm. And it says, in reading the lives of great men, I added great women. I said, in reading the lives of great men and great women, the first victory they won was over themselves. With all of them, self-discipline, commitment came first. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have to start with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Before we start with anybody else.
Mm.
Like, you should never try and give a lesson to anyone else unless you've almost mastered that lesson yourself. And I'm very far from mastering these lessons. But, you know, I take commitment to a crazy level. Most kids don't believe me when I say this, but I haven't said a curse word in 20 years.
Wow.
Now, someone's going to rewind this and say, you said the word bastard. I don't consider that a curse word. So Orlando's never heard me curse.
I don't think I have.
No, you haven't. Like, he'll say maybe he has, but he hasn't.
I don't recall. And I can't recall the time. That
now, I mean, I will say some things, but like the big S word or F word, nobody's heard me say.
Hmm.
Yeah, I could say that. Maybe I've heard you say piss. Or maybe damn and telling a story. Yeah, exactly. Those are nothing. I've been saying that since I was three. You know. No, but yeah, no, I agree. I've never heard you say any of the other big ones. Shit, fuck, bitch, nothing like that. I've never heard
you. Do you bleep those out of this?
No. But you're right. I mean.
The funny thing is, I don't think cursing's wrong. Is that
you
a
guys
baby?
Can keep talking. I'm going to go be a mom.
That's a baby crying.
Yeah.
That's commitment. Right there.
So what's going on here, listeners, is Nicole's got to go be a mom. As we're tying this up, the baby has decided it's time to wake up for a little while.
At 11:38 p.m.
Yeah, it's been a while.
You're
going to
have a great night tonight,
things.
Orlando.
No, I'm blessed with a beautiful relationship with a great woman, and she ensures that I get a good night of sleep, and she takes care of our beautiful baby.
You realize this is archived now.
That's right. I have no problem saying it. But listen, we could talk for hours. I hope we continue to do this. I think we're going to get some people that really enjoy this. The show that I did recently with someone, everyone's hoping I do that again. I have a feeling we're going to get the same feedback with you, where people can say, hey, can you have him on again? We just enjoyed talking to him. We just knocked out an hour and a half, and we barely touched the tip of the iceberg. But I know Nicole would love to do this again, so hopefully we can do this. Where can everybody find you real quick before we... No, go ahead.
Thank yeah, they're going to find her in the baby's room.
Yeah. No, they're about to find Mama. That's right. But where can everybody find you guys for Sweethearts and Heroes? Let's talk real quick. You're open to speak to anybody, any level, high schools. Predominantly, you prefer school-age kids?
No, I mean, you know, this is a longer discussion.
But yeah, because the message goes to everybody.
So we do K-2, 3-5, middle school, high school, but it's a human message.
Yeah.
We do a tremendous amount of professional development, and you know, something I don't even talk much about is there's a lot of corporate work we do too.
Right.
I really enjoy doing leadership, motivational goal setting things with companies, and it allows us to weave this message. And, you know, I talked about student empowerment and empathy activation, which we didn't even get into, the empathy activation side. She just went back to bed. But, you know, if I had to summarize Sweethearts and Heroes into two words, and we didn't even talk what Sweethearts and Heroes mean.
Right.
And it's very specific what a sweetheart is and what a hero is.
Right.
But it really comes down to hope and action. And I think that we all have the ability to give hope to others and take action to help people that are suffering. And, you know, so I think that message belongs everywhere in humanity.
So listen, folks and friends, if you know anyone, please check out Sweethearts and Heroes on YouTube, Instagram. You can find a bunch of good stuff. If you know anyone, excuse me?
We'll link everything.
Yeah, everything will be linked here in the show description. But if you know anyone that's looking for somebody to come in and talk to your friends, family, anything you could think of, these guys are really, you've spoke to how many kids now in the last decade?
Oh, a million? I've been saying a million for about the last 4 years.
Yeah, so
it's probably a million and a half.
These guys have been all over the country. Really a great message. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please check them out, Sweethearts and Heroes. And we will definitely do this again soon with Tom. There's a lot of other things
we
could talk about.
There's so many things that we could go on.
So thank you for listening. Please let everybody know.
Favorite topic.
And you all be peace. Tell them bye, Tom.
Bye, Tom.
Bye, Tom.